Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State. The best outcomes for treating cancer come from early detection. The James Cancer Diagnostic Center is designed to provide rapid evaluation and a clear diagnosis to those who suspect they have cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/diagnosticcenter.
Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. What if the traditional way doctors gauge patient health misses the mark? You know, the rapid-fire question-and-answer approach. Where does it hurt? How long have you felt like this? What medications are you currently taking? What if the tools doctors really need to assess their patients come not from science, but from literature? An approach known as narrative medicine is emerging across the profession, at Ohio State and elsewhere. Tomorrow, on October 30th, Ohio State will host a panel titled The Power of Narrative Medicine, When Doctors and Patients Tell Their Stories. Dr. Erin McConnell is an associate professor in clinical medicine at Ohio State's Wexner Medical Center. She's a panelist at the upcoming event. Welcome to All Sides, Dr. McConnell.
Thank you for having me.
And also joining us is another panelist, James Phelan, a distinguished university professor of English at Ohio State. He's the director of Medical Humanities and Project Narrative at Ohio State, and he's written several books on the topic, including Somebody Telling Somebody Else. Welcome to All Sides, Professor Phelan.
Thank you, Amy.
So together, Dr. McConnell and Professor Phelan co-led a course entitled Literature for Physicians, From the Page to the Bedside. So I'm fascinated even by the title of that course and this topic altogether. So I want to learn more about narrative medicine in practice. So Dr. McConnell, I'll start with you. You know, I started with that scenario at the beginning of doctors rattling off questions, you know, trying to figure out how are you doing? What's wrong? Is that a realistic portrayal of a common doctor-patient encounter?
Unfortunately, yes. There's been some studies to suggest that we let people talk for about 15 seconds before we interrupt, which is, I guess, tragic but true. I think that part of our time constraints are that most patient visits are going to be 15 to 20 minutes, and we're trying to kind of accomplish our objectives, which are providing the best care for patients based on guidelines, and then also trying to accomplish what patients want to make sure we cover. And that's assuming that both of us are running on time, which is usually not the case. Mm-hmm. So trying to collect as much information as we can, also to make it fit our kind of our illness scripts that we are taught in medical school. But I think a more useful kind of employment of the time together would be just to let people tell you their stories. Mm-hmm. And it has been shown to be just as efficient, you know, maybe add 15 to 20 seconds to the encounter and maybe convey a lot more information.
So what is narrative medicine? How is it different than the standard practice of just asking questions and listening for 15 seconds?
So I think it's letting people tell you their story and taking into context the, who, what, when, where, why, or kind of employing some of Jim's framework, the somebody telling somebody else something for a certain purpose, as opposed to trying to do the, like a contrast to this would be evidence-based medicine or the QRSPT, the pain questions of like, where's the pain? How long have you had the pain for? But trying to codify the chief complaints that patients are having and whatnot. Instead of just eliciting information for the chief complaint at hand, we're actually trying to understand where the patient's coming from, what context they're telling the story from, and more about the patient so we can make sense of their illness and the patient's, the context of their life.
Right. If someone comes to you with knee pain, but they tell you a story of like they want to bend down and pick up their grandkid, that the knee pain is different, right?
Yeah. Making meaning of what matters to them.
How did you get interested in narrative medicine?
I think I've always been interested in literature and medicine. I've been writing stories since I was a child and reading books since a child. I tried to do English and chemistry as an undergrad, and I was communicating with the producer prior to coming on here that I was proposing an English PhD as my physician scientist pathway. But this was prior to Rita Sharon, who's kind of the grandmother of narrative medicine. She proposed the term, I think, in 2001 as a study of literature and medicine. But back when I was applying to medical schools in 2003, I don't think it was widely accepted. Mm. So the physician scientist programs I was applying to just kind of looked at me like, yeah, we don't do that, the English and medicine approach. Proposing that the study of literature can make physicians more empathic and better physicians kind of landed weirdly, and might still to some people. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I feel like that just works a part of our brain and our souls that the scientific aspect of medicine doesn't necessarily directly oppose, but might like kill off a little bit. There's only so much science and evidence that we can take without sacrificing a little bit of our humanity.
Professor Phelan, I'd like to bring you into the conversation here. So why do you think it is that medical students are not encouraged to embrace both disciplines?
Well, I do think there's been enormous success in some measures with the scientific and technological approach to medicine, right? If you think about the kind of advances that we have made in treatments of various things, right? It's pretty impressive. So in a sense, that kind of success says, well, let's, you know, double down, let's keep going, right? And so I also think there's a kind of general divide in our culture. I mean, C.P. Snow talked about it back in the 50s, right? The science and the humanities. And that leads to certain kinds of specialization, right? So many medical students think, all right, what I need to do is become really adept at the STEM fields, right? And then humanities, literature, not so much, not so important, right? So I think that I point to both of those things, right? Sort of the success of the scientific model and the sort of cultural divide between STEM and the humanities.
What do you think of when you hear about Dr. McConnell saying she was kind of ahead of her time, where she wanted to pursue English but she couldn't because they basically said we don't do that here. What do you think of that? Like, is she kind of a unicorn, or were there a lot of people out there like that?
I don't really know. I mean, I haven't done that. But I mean, when I was an undergraduate at Boston College, the English major was a very popular major, and there were a lot of my classmates were doing English pre-med, you know, and I think over time that's faded. I wasn't interested in medicine. It didn't, you know, it didn't appeal to me. It's hard to say, right? Mm-hmm. There are some programs that have, some medical schools have emphasize the value of a sort of humanities training at undergraduates. So, and I think, you know, Rita Sharon's work and the emergence of the narrative medicine movement has made it more popular. So Erin was maybe once a unicorn, but no, she's not so much.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR.
Turned into a horse.
Yeah, got it. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about narrative medicine with Dr. Erin McConnell and Professor James Phelan from Ohio State. They're participating in a panel tomorrow, October 30th, on the topic. I wanted to play some audio featuring the doctor we've been talking about, Dr. Rita Sharon, from Columbia University. She's widely credited with pioneering the practice. She is on the New England Journal of Medicine podcast, explaining narrative medicine to students and young doctors.
So it's not, and the medical students listening will know what I'm talking about immediately. It's not the same as communication skills. It's not like a little script that you use to get through a review of systems. Right. Instead, it's a very deep personal presence as a listener, as a receiver, as a witness, as a patient is struggling to put into words what he or she is going through.
Yeah, Professor Phelan, let's talk about what she said there for a moment, because I would think that good communication skills would help the doctor, but tell me how it's deeper, it's different than communication skills.
Right. So this is the key, in a way, that makes someone like me feel like I have something to contribute, right? Mm. The idea that if we say, as Rita does, as Erin just said, narrative competence is going to enhance medical competence, then we need to think about, well, what do we mean by narrative competence, right? And there's this whole field of narrative theory, right? And studying storytelling, how it works, right? And what does it mean to be a good listener, a good storyteller and a good listener to stories? And it's that aspect that I think Rita is trying to tap into there to say there's something more than just communication skills, because it's the communication of a story and it's the ability to listen to that story, to its different parts, its different components, what's being said explicitly, maybe what's being implied, and tease that out.
Like reading comprehension skills. That's tested on a lot in elementary school, whether like you can read the passage and get the answer right, but did you comprehend the paragraph?
Right. 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 And in a way of, you know, what's a sort of a narrative analysis, narrative comprehension, what's being foregrounded, right? What's the plot, right? Mm-hmm. When you say what's the plot, then what are the instabilities? What are the complications? Do we have a resolution? We probably don't have a resolution, which is why the patient is here. But what if I pay attention to the story of the instabilities and complications, how will that inform our working together to find some kind of resolution?
The clip we just heard from Dr. Sharon, she says in another part of it that Henry James was a foundational writer for her. So Professor Phelan, why do you think Henry James's work resonated?
Yeah, Henry James is famous for A, difficulty, but yeah. B, psychological insight, right? And the thing about James is he's a challenging writer, especially later James. But it's if you attend, and to use one of Rita's favorite words, if you attend carefully to the nuances of his prose, there's an enormous payoff. The rewards of reading James are rich. And so I think that's, in a way, then the sort of her recognition is, all right, well, the kinds of skills I need and the kinds of rewards I can get from my encounters with James, if I can transfer that to the clinic, then I'm onto something.
Dr. McConnell, is there an author whose work helped you when it came to practicing narrative medicine?
I feel like it'd be hard to choose one. I think of it like the quote unquote like real authors, you know, or like bona fide like fiction writers and whatnot. So I think of like Toni Morrison, Colson Whitehead, whose work is just beautiful and moving. And then I think of kind of the physician authors. And so, you know, I start with like Richard Seltzer, Atul Gawande, of course. He's done so many excellent works just talking about physician-patient communication. Paul Kalanithi, if I'm saying his name correctly. All of those have really impacted my communication with patients. Something I read recently is Bessel van der Kolk, who wrote about the Body Keep Score, and it's an informed book about how patients process trauma throughout their lives and how that can inform everything that how we process all of our encounters with people.
Yeah. And Dr. McConnell, you specialize in internal medicine and pediatrics, so you're seeing adults and children. How does narrative medicine differ with age groups?
That's a great question. I don't know that I differentiate between the two. I just think of the stories as like different levels. So if that makes sense. So I might be like more, I don't want to say elementary with kids, but just that kids will tell me stories maybe more readily, and they may be a little bit harder to follow just if they're a little creative and whatnot. But I always let the patient tell me the story. So even if it's a two-year-old, I'll ask them to give me the history of present illness. And some two-year-olds give me more easy to follow narratives than others. But I'm always trying to make sure that the patient, whoever they are, whatever age they are, is the front and center of the communication. And then I, jokingly say you can phone a friend if you need help with giving me this history and whatnot, but I always want whoever is the person coming in for the appointment to feel like they're at the center of the interaction. I think that also helps with kind of acquiring skills, because no one, you know, in school learns to be a patient. That's not part of our high school curriculum, that this is how you, you know, give a history. This is how you take care of yourself as an adult. This is how you make an appointment. This is how you give a family history and whatnot. So I feel like it's kind of good kind of on the job training for being a person as well.
Yeah. And Professor Phelan, I mentioned that you work with medical humanities and then also project narrative at Ohio State. Can you tell me about these two facets of your life and how it, you know, feeds into work of doctors like Dr. McConnell?
Right. So one thing I would say, the medical humanities is a broader field, mm-hmm. right? And yeah. narrative medicine would be a subset of that, okay. right? So medical humanities and social sciences, we have an MA program that is, you know, interdisciplinary for humanities and social sciences. And the sort of motivating rationale for that is to say that the perspectives that we can bring from English, philosophy, history, psychology, anthropology, sociology to medical practice give us a kind of insight into it that we're not getting with the science and technology aspect. So that's sort of the broad thing.
Yeah.
And then with Project Narrative and Narrative Medicine, it's this the subset then to say, all right, well, how does narrative work, right? What do we know about that? What have great writers done? What kinds of, one of the things that I'm interested in is sort of the resources of narrative, right? Mm-hmm. So what's a character, right? Or plot, what's a plot? How do we think about that? How can we, develop a sort of conceptual tools that are portable across a range of narratives. Mm. So when we become skillful at that, then when we can then say, okay, well, here's some tools that we can give caregivers who are interested in narrative medicine. And not just that it's stories, yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And those stories have effects, so we can pay attention to them. But then we can dive a little bit deeper and see how the stories are working, and then once we see how the stories are working, we can see, all right, what else is being communicated than just, okay, I have this pain.
And you co-lead a course that's called Literature for Physicians, From the Page to the Bedside. Is this for undergrads? Is this required? Who takes this course?
Medical students. It's an OSU College of Medicine course.
Okay. Is it required?
It's not required.
It's an elective. Okay.
It's an elective. Yeah.
Self-selected.
Okay. So is it for med students? And just tell me a little bit about what you cover in the course, for Literature for Physicians, From the Page to the Bedside. Yeah. Either one of you.
It's what we call an advanced competency. So there's a number of different ones students can choose from. So it is a bit self-selected, but mm-hmm. it's for students from first through fourth years. And it's longitudinal, meaning they can attend their 8 sessions anywhere from the first year to the fourth year. So they're 2.5-hour seminars. We limit the sessions to 25 students per seminar to make it kind of a small group discussion type format. And for their capstone projects, they have to do a project. And sometimes it'll involve like leading a session. So a lot of our sessions, the students will lead the actual discussion of the text that we're discussing. So they'll select the text, they'll write a lesson plan, they'll lead the discussion. Mm-hmm. So Jim and I haven't led a discussion in like years, which is probably good. I don't know. That's a good a good problem to have, is so many students wanting to lead discussions. Or they'll write essays. We've had students do podcasts. We've had students do creative pieces, stuff like that. So it's just really a nice way to stretch that part of the brain. And we encourage people to do, there's very popular, like the Togo Days, the physician literature section of that, and nonfiction and things about medicine. But also we just did like Kristen Hannah's The Nightingale last night was our a selection for the piece and stuff. And then we're doing the women next month. So it's Krista Hannah all the time. Yeah.
Krista Hannah.
Senior season.
All right. Well, we'll discuss this course a little bit more. Coming up, our discussion of narrative medicine continues. Our guests are staying with us, Dr. Aaron McConnell and Professor James Phelan of Ohio State. All Sides continues in a moment on 89.7 NPR News.
Sources and methods, the crown jewels of the intelligence community. Shorthand for how do we know what's real? Who told us? If you have those answers, you're on the inside, and NPR wants to bring you there. From the Pentagon to the State Department to spy agencies, listen to understand what's really happening and what it means for you. Sources and Methods, the new national security podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. What if the tools doctors really need to assess their patients come not just from science, but also from literature? An approach known as narrative medicine is emerging across the profession, at Ohio State and elsewhere. Tomorrow, October 30th, Ohio State will host a panel titled The Power of Narrative Medicine, When Doctors and Patients Tell Their Stories. And we're talking about narrative medicine this hour with some of the panelists who will be at that event. Still with us is Dr. Aaron McConnell, Associate Professor in Clinical Medicine at Ohio State's Wexner Medical Center. Thanks for being here, Dr. McConnell.
Thank you for having us.
And Professor James Phelan, Director of Medical Humanities and Project Narrative at Ohio State. He's written several books on the topic, including Somebody Telling Somebody Else. Thanks for being here, Professor.
My pleasure.
So in today's healthcare landscape, there's a premium on time, and doctors do spend time with patients, but does the narrative medicine approach, I mean, how much more time are we talking? Do they need to change these 15-minute appointments to 30 minutes?
I don't think that's our medical system's going to facilitate that.
Yeah.
So I think part of it's just listening better or being more present. As weird as it sounds, I think that the AI technology that's helping kind of scribe some of our visits is actually going to help with that, because we can actually turn, listen to the patient and be present with them and not worry about kind of jotting down every little detail that you're going to forget at the end of the day as you're trying to compose your note later. So as weird as it sounds, that the technology may actually help us be more present for patients at the time. If I can turn away from my computer and not be typing furiously and looking at the patient at the same time, but making eye contact, nodding, listening to the patient, and actually kind of echoing back what I'm hearing them say, I feel like that makes for a more effective visit and I'm more present in the moment with them.
Whenever we were talking about narrative medicine, I was reminded of an episode from the Emmy-winning show The Pitt. You know, it's a show that takes place in an ER in Pittsburgh. This is from episode 3 of that season. Dr. Robbie is played by Noah Wiley, who is also of ER fame. And he is basically chastising a medical resident named Dr. Samira Mohan for spending too much time with a sickle cell anemia patient when the ER is busy and overflowing.
You're an R3. As an R3, you should be seeing at least 2 patients an hour.
I have 2. Joyce and Mr. Wallace are good Samaritans.
Who's comatose and stable? You should have 4 by now.
I have the highest patient satisfaction of anyone.
I don't doubt it, but we just had this conversation a couple hours ago.
I know people call me slow-mo.
Because you're afraid of making a mistake?
I'm always afraid of making a mistake, aren't you?
Yeah, of course I am, but you know what I mean. You make a mistake once and somebody dies and you feel so badly about it, you'll never let it happen.
How is that wrong?
Because you waste time and money on unnecessary tests. You keep sick patients waiting too long. You miss out on cases you could be learning from. You shortchange your own education.
So basically, in that interaction between those two doctors, Dr. Robbie is telling Dr. Mohan that she's not going fast enough. You know, they call her slow-mo because she spends too much time with the patients. What do you think of whenever shows like that portray doctors in that way? I mean, are you on Dr. Mohan's side here?
Yes. I've been accused maybe of writing like too long of notes or taking too long in patient rooms as well, especially like at that point in my career, like that learning stage. And it kind of hurts, I think, just because time is valuable, and especially for more so medical students, but residents too. That's one of our currencies is time, more time than maybe the attendings have. And so with our students, especially in class, I try to encourage them that is one gift they have to give people, because with medical students, I think they become concerned about, like, I'm wasting someone's time. They don't need my exam. They don't need my interview. Someone else is going to get this information. So for medical students, at least, I try to emphasize that your time is actually a gift to the patients, because you're spending time with them. You're, validating their symptoms, their concerns. You're spending a lot more time with them than the attendings, the residents are, and whatnot. In this situation, I think that she's providing quality care and she's advocating for patients. And this particular episode, the person with sickle cell disease was actually being kind of manhandled by police officers, and she's advocating for patient equity and fair treatment, and that population has historically been I mean, maligned by medical providers. So I think that, you know, kind of hearing even Dr. Robbie, who's kind of like the, you know, good guy in the series, you know, chastise her for this, I think it lands very poorly.
Even the good guy says she's going to
yeah,
slap.
I mean, yeah. It's like, get over yourself. You know?
I mean, yeah, from the narrative perspective, right, it is interesting then that, okay, the show is presenting him as the authority figure, the good guy, and he you know, articulates his position, right? But there's also in the scene itself the seeds of the need for him to change his mind, right, mm-hmm. over time, right? Because she says, well, I have the best, you know, patient satisfaction mm-hmm. scores, et cetera. We've also seen, you know, the scene in which she's treated the person who's been, the patient mm-hmm. who's been manhandled by the police. So the narrative is a little more complex than just, okay, here's Dr. Robbie, you know, our authority figure giving us the whole story, mm-hmm. right? And so, you know, so be worth paying attention to, all right, well, what happens to Shlomo and Dr. Robbie mm-hmm. from this point? Is, you know, does she become sort of vindicated?
Yeah. And I think reaching out to more of the context of the whole story, like Dr. Robbie being browbeaten by his, you know, right. hospital director about how he needs to be faster and have better patient satisfaction scores. And it's just like chasing your tail. It's like no right. one's happy. No one's yeah. doing a good job. And so it's just trickle down economics where he's beating up on the people underneath him about the very thing that he can't compensate for himself. So it's just crazy.
Yeah. Professor Phelan, what do you say to something Dr. McConnell was saying earlier where like, time is a currency, and for I would think for medical students, anyone in medicine, an ER doctor, they don't have much time. So this idea of spending a lot of time taking a course on literature whenever they have so much to learn to pass their medical boards, why should they spend the time reading Kristen Hannah's Nightingale? That's a really long book,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, right. Yeah. Right. Well, I do think, you know, the people who, the students take this course as an elective, as we mm-hmm. said, right? Mm-hmm. And they tell us, right, they really like it because it's different, mm-hmm. because they're asked to exercise different parts of their brain, mm-hmm. because they are always looking for connections between the situations in the fiction that we're reading and what they're learning in medical school, right? So it's, I would say, It's another part of their curriculum, mm-hmm. right? Not an add-on or a side thing or a book club, right? But something that's integral to habits and modes of thought and approaches to the work they're going to be doing.
Now, obviously, Ohio State cares about this. They have your two departments that you're working in. Project Narrative exists. How do you see medical schools around the country, other places incorporating this into training? I mean, do you think it's something that can happen on a large scale, or is it going to need people like you in every medical school to do it?
Yeah, well, I think in general, like this, any other sort of movement in mm-hmm. the academy, right, it does require people like Rita Sharon, right, and mm-hmm. and to sort of put a vision out there and start to implement things, and then other people see that there's value and they pick it up. So just in the last 6 months, I've been asked to write a foreword for a book about narrative medicine workshops.
Okay,
and I've been asked to evaluate a manuscript for a narrative medicine anthology, you know, and so you can see it's growing, right? And there's Rita has developed a whole an MA program, and she does lots of workshops at Columbia. Now there are people at the University of Southern California who are developing a sort of similar program. So I do think like, in the last 25 years, mm-hmm. there's a lot of evidence that this is spreading. Everybody not everybody's on board, but and which Erin could probably talk about some more.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about narrative medicine with Professor James Phelan from Ohio State and Dr. Erin McConnell. They're participating in a panel tomorrow on the topic. So, yeah, Dr. McConnell, talk about that. Do you hear from other doctors, even at Ohio State, who say, I don't need narrative medicine. I'm doing just fine with my numbers and my data.
I don't hear so much a dissing of it. I just hear feedback that there's not enough time. So we tried to do an interest group for a while and actually had like a fair amount of verbal interest in it. So lots of people saying like, oh, I really, I get the emails inviting me to this. I like to read the stories. I like to think about attending this group. And it was a once a month session.
And we were doing workshops. I mean, just so read a short story, discuss it, write a little something, share the writing. So just an hour.
Yeah. And it was actually really, I really enjoyed it. It was really fun. And I, whenever we had the group, it was like a very small group, but a very warm, enjoyable group. But at the same time, it's just, you know, trying to find a time that fit for people that they weren't trying to get their kids to bed or finishing up their charts and stuff like that. So just kind of a hard thing to commit. It would be probably better to have something like that, you know, like that it could be, you know, like a podcast where they could do it on their own. But then that loses the purpose of, you know, doing a writing exercise and sharing your work with other people and stuff like that. So I think a big kind of time, it's a time suck for people. And so that's their biggest argument against narrative medicine. It's not so much that it's not a useful tool. It's just that, how am I going to fit this in? Like, where can I, you know, possibly work this into my day given everything else that's going on in my life?
Do you need more support from the administration then, maybe to give doctors an hour a month for this?
Oh, man, that'd be amazing. But yeah, I don't see that.
You don't see that happening.
No, that'd be lovely, though.
Well, what if we started with students? So if you would teach it at the student level, maybe when I hate to say arguably students have more time, but if you teach it into them, then it'll always stay there, whether you're, you know, a fully grown up physician and you don't have the time. You're nodding your head. Yeah.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, that's one of the hopes of the, you know, from the page to the bedside course, yeah. Right? That we're developing this as habit, you know, an approach, right? Integrate it with everything else. That you're learning.
Right, right. And Professor Phelan, you also recently traveled to Finland, where you learned how other countries are using narrative medicine. I recently did a series about schools. Finland does a good job with schools. Does Finland also do a good job with this? Finland's just the best.
Well, happiest country.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the conference I was at, there were a couple sessions or panels on narrative medicine. And yeah, it was really interesting to see what they were doing with it. And there was a lot of enthusiasm for it. There was one particular panel on the narrative medicine workshops where one of the things that's often suggested is that the participants in the workshop take a story and do what we call creative rewriting. Mm. So if it's from one character's perspective, take the same scene and write it from another character's perspective, right? And then what do you learn from that? What do you learn about narrative? What do you learn about situation? What do you learn about perspective taking? You know, that kind of thing. And I think that's also spreading. And clearly that's a big interest in Finland.
Yeah. Do you, Dr. McConnell, do you feel like giving them smaller chunks, these like shorter stories that Professor Phelan mentioned, is that more tangible? I mean, I doubt you're going to get a very busy doctor to read Henry James, right?
Oh, no, definitely not. So with the interest groups and the workshops we were doing, we tried to make it so that it was a very short story or poem, and then also have it accessible with like the New Yorker fiction podcast so that they could listen or read it. But yeah, just very small bites, just because, you know, that nobody's got a lot of time.
And just as a final question, Professor Phelan, do you see an application that extends beyond medicine? I mean, would it benefit all of us to be maybe better listeners to stories?
Yes. You're talking about my career. So yes. I mean, yeah. But the other thing, I mean, just to you know, make it a little bit more academic, one of the things that has happened is that the study of narrative has moved beyond the study of literary narrative to the study of narrative in, you know, we call it the narrative turn in multiple disciplines, right? So in law, in business, in economics, et cetera.
Okay. Yeah. Well, Dr. McConnell is going to stay with us, but right now we're going to say goodbye to Professor James Phelan, the Director of Medical Humanities and Project Narrative at Ohio State. Professor, thanks for being here today.
My pleasure. Thanks. Thank you.
And then coming up, we're going to talk with a patient whose embrace of narrative medicine helped her and her family work through some longstanding trauma. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Sources and methods, the crown jewels of the intelligence community. Shorthand for how do we know what's real? Who told us? If you have those answers, you're on the inside, and NPR wants to bring you there. From the Pentagon to the State Department to spy agencies, listen to understand what's really happening and what it means for you. Sources and Methods, the new national security podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Telling stories is not just for entertaining. They're for enlightening. They're for educating. They're for healing. For helping doctors treat patients. And for helping patients heal. This hour, we're talking about narrative medicine. Still with us is Dr. Erin McConnell from Ohio State's Wexner Medical Center. Thanks again for being here today.
Thanks so much.
And joining us now is artist and author Patricia Wynn Brown of Columbus. Welcome back to All Sides, Pat.
Thanks, Amy.
So you're a creative person, you're a performer, and you recently published your memoir. It's called Royal Roots, Reimagining a Life Through Humor, a Castle, and the U.S. Navy. And you've also been a patient, having been treated for malignant melanoma. Tell me, how did you learn about narrative medicine?
I've always been interested in stories. Mm-hmm. And I'm interested in the power of stories. And so when I started writing a column for the alternative papers, they were stories about my own life, and they were filled with humor. And then I did a one-woman show called Hair Theater Beauty School, and I told the stories of my life through the evolution of my hairdos. Mm-hmm. And it really resonated with the audience. And at the end of these shows or with my stories that I wrote, people would say, I needed that laugh more than you'll ever know. Mm. So I'm not a physician, but I am a storyteller. And in that art form, and I'm a dancer as well, in that art form, I'm able to transform the things that have happened in my life into words or into humor or into dance moves. And it has helped me greatly, and it has helped my audiences, as has the new memoir, Royal Roots, which it's sort of a DIY narrative medicine where I started out to tell a story that I was never to tell and that no one ever asked me about and no one discussed with me in my own home, with relatives, with teachers, with doctors. One doctor, one time, wrote on my chart, worry wart. And that's as close as they got, worry wart. But he didn't ask me what I was worried about. And what I was worried about is what I wrote about in Royal Roots, which was growing up in the 50s and 60s after World War II with a PTSD, severely mentally ill father who died a headline-grabbing death in 1980, having flashbacks from the war. And he was in a shootout with the police in my grandparents' front yard. And I never knew what happened to him in the war. So I started writing this book. And it deals with humor. Comedy and tragedy are both contained in humor. And while writing it, I wrote to the Freedom of Information Act and received all his psychiatric records and found out what happened to him. And I was near completion of this book. And it put everything in perspective to know that story. And it also set me free. And Dr. Sharon talks about asking her patient, what is stalking you? Mm. And it took me 70 years to discover how to deal with what is stalking me. And it was what we went through in our family and how the arts and humor and the Mickey Mouse Club and I Love Lucy and literature and movies all helped me to process this as I went along. But writing Royal Roots really untangled the knots, and I was able to see clearly. So I felt a burden lifted, and also I felt redemption for my father for reading the stories in that doctor's own handwriting in 200 pages of his report.
And Dr. McConnell, what does that make you think of whenever if a patient comes to you and they have anxiety, but, you know, they're being called a worrywart. But if you ask them what's behind it or that kind of thing of like talking with them about the bigger picture or asking for a story. I mean, hearing a story like that, it might be more than a doctor signed up for at that moment. But what does that make you think of what you're going to learn about your patient?
I think oftentimes it takes time and I guess reassurance that we're there to listen. So even if it's not the first time we offer to listen, because I think that type of story would take a lot of trust and a long relationship and a lot of time commitment to elicit from somebody. And also just, you know, not something that I would expect someone to just, you know, immediately trust me and just deliver all that in one visit. And also a lot of perception on the part of the provider to be like, oh, you know, this is someone who's survived a lot of trauma. Let me get to the bottom of this in one visit. Yeah. But just being there, offering the listening, being perceptive enough to pick up on the fact that, you know, you could say this person's a worrywart, this person has a lot of anxiety, or you could be like, what trauma does this patient carry? You know, what happened to this person?
And to that point, whenever they would take the history, my personal history, and after my dad died, it was such a shameful experience. Mm-hmm. And it was shameful in the 50s and 60s to have a mentally ill family member. So I didn't want to talk about it. And probably to this day, when a doctor asks me, you know, how did your mother die? How did your father die? I say, for my father, his heart just stopped because I know they can't get into this. And I've had therapy. Mm-hmm. And this is a case where therapy is needed. And perhaps a doctor would say, it sounds like you're really struggling with this. Mm-hmm. And I think therapy would help you all the way around with all your health. But I didn't want to talk about it because part of the memoir is the shame involved in a situation like that, that to even speak of it, because I was forbidden to talk about it at home.
So whenever you would tell a doctor, like, because they need to know your medical history to understand you better. So if you would tell them my father's heart stopped, the doctor's like, oh, okay, a history of heart disease in the family. And then they just move on. Is that?
Yeah. And I'm a really good actress. So I would say it like this. His heart just stopped.
Which is true.
Yeah. It's true.
You weren't lying.
To a point.
Yes.
Yes.
You were admitting, but you weren't lying.
Yeah.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about narrative medicine with Dr. Erin McConnell from Ohio State's Wexner Medical Center and with artist and author Patricia Wynn Brown. And tomorrow, October 30th, Ohio State will host a panel that is titled The Power of Narrative Medicine, When Doctors and Patients Tell Their Stories. Dr. McConnell, how do you see creativity helping those in the medical profession deal with stress? You know, Pat has a lot of experience with a lot of creative outlets that helped with her to deal with her trauma that she didn't even maybe know what she was doing with all of her creative outlets. So what do you see? You know, there's a lot of stressors. There's workload, staffing shortage, conflicting medical information at the federal level, you know, all of this.
Sorry for laughing.
Yeah. How can doctors use creativity or even narrative medicine to deal with their own stress?
I think it can be a huge kind of pop-off valve or release. Like, I can say that even just like listening to an audiobook, I feel like I'm transported. It's almost like a baptism, especially if it's especially well-written. I have done less personal writing lately, but I'm actually really looking forward to getting back to that just because it's like, as Jim and I were discussing earlier, exercising a different part of your brain and giving yourself permission to like feel and process in the act of. So even though I think a lot of it can be judging it as it comes out, it needs to not be for that purpose. It just needs to be for, you know, actually just being human and working through some of this day-to-day stress.
Mm-hmm. And Pat, what made it important to you to be a part of this panel that they're having? You know, it's the power of narrative medicine when doctors and patients tell their stories. Why was it important to you for about this panel?
I'm on the medicine and arts board at OSU. And mm-hmm. so we bring the arts to the students. And I know how important it is as a stress reliever for the students. So when I wrote Royal Roots, I suggested to the board that we do something on narrative medicine mm-hmm. because I've used the book at the women's prison in Marysville at the Ohio Reformatory for Women. And they have said, oh, I read it and I've learned to turn my trauma into triumph. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was just so wonderful. So we started with who's doing this type of thing here? And Dr. Linda Stone, who initiated the Medicine and Arts Board, knew about Dr. Phelan. Dr. Phelan knew about Dr. McConnell. Dr. McConnell knew about Dr. Cooper. And Dr. Phelan knew about Kelly Trinosky mm-hmm. because she just got her master's under his guidance. And she deals with trauma and collages. So we're all in the panel. And then Mike Horgan, who leads our board, put the whole thing together. Mm-hmm. And we have met and discussed. And one of the big things about this, I'm glad about the panel, but I am so relieved to meet Dr. McConnell and Dr. Phelan and Dr. Cooper and Kelly because they're doing this in the field and people will benefit from this so greatly. And it was something that I never had and I wish I did have. And I know it would have made a difference earlier than 70 years. I know it would. So it gives me great hope during these dark times that somebody's going to listen to somebody's story and hear what's going on in their life and see that person. They are seen, they are understood, and they are accepted. And when I finished this book and started speaking to groups, I felt like I found my place in the world because I always felt like I was on the outside looking in, which benefits a writer because I observe everything, but I'm also hypersensitive about everything. So this has been something for me of like a moment, and it's exciting, and I do hope it spreads.
Yeah, and you have said, Pat, that you have used basically it's self-administered narrative medicine.
That's
what
right.
you did. So, and you've said that we can all practice narrative medicine. So tell me more about that.
We can. And when I talk to my groups about it, and I talked to a book club, Leanna's book club yesterday, and I just told them our stories are our crown jewels. And everybody has a Netflix miniseries in them. Every single person. Every single person is interesting, and their stories are of such value. They could jot it down on a piece of scrap paper, a story, or they could make a piece of art. Carrie Fisher said, take your broken heart and make it into art. Mm-hmm. And you don't have to be a great artist to do that. You could just use your kids' crayons and make a picture, or take some leaves and make a formation. Make a pretend book. Get some paper, put it together, the story of my life, and write the story of your life. We don't have to do things formally, and we don't have to do things to perfection. For instance, at Flux and Flow, where I do dance, it's for mm-hmm. adults only, all ages, all sizes. We're going into a ballet performance of all adults. You know, we're not the American Ballet Company, but we are Flux and Flow. And you don't have to do everything just like the experts do to gain the benefit from it.
And Dr. McConnell, you know, we talked earlier about how it can help a patient. You know, the doctor needs to know the who, what, where, and when, you know, to diagnose a medical condition. But asking about the why and how, that's narrative medicine, right?
Yeah, I think so. And also just being there with them and acknowledging that sometimes we don't have all the answers, but to be there witnessing what they're going through and letting them know that they're not going through it alone, I think that's narrative medicine too.
And Pat, the panel tomorrow, is it for just for doctors? Is it for the public? Who are you hoping listens?
It's open to the public, and it's free, 12:15, Myling Hall on the campus. And we have about 100 people registered already to come to that panel, which is fantastic.
There's a Zoom link, too, so it's free for everybody.
Oh, so you can watch it, too?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we have 1 minute left. What do you hope people learn from it, either one of you?
Your story matters.
Okay. And Pat, now we have time for you.
and also, truly, and I want to just reiterate, our stories are our crown jewels, and they are precious, and they are to be respected and honored and cherished.
We have been talking about narrative medicine, and we've been talking with Dr. Erin McConnell from Ohio State's Wexner Medical Center. Dr. McConnell, thanks so much for being here today.
Thanks so much for having us.
And we've also been talking with artist and author Patricia Wynn Brown of Columbus, and Pat's memoir is called Royal Roots, Reimagining a Life Through Humor, a Castle, and the U.S. Navy. Pat, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Amy.
And again, the panel is tomorrow, October 30th. Ohio State will host this panel, and it's titled The Power of Narrative Medicine When Doctors and Patients Tell Their Stories. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jarovich. Thanks for joining us.